I'm just reading that close to 80% of the Dutch went and voted. That is massive, I think, in the UK. Normally, you barely make 50, don't you? Yeah, 80%, 78.2%. The guy who's won, he's the guy with the dyed hair. He's often likened to Hitler. He's a very strange character. He's himself married to a Hungarian woman, but absolutely hates immigrants. Out of 150 seats in the Dutch lower house, he's won 37. He was predicted to get around about 25, so that would be 1/6. So 15% of the vote. He used to just have one or two seats, but he used to always, in this horrendous system that is proportional representation, he used to make up the majority. So the right-wing party, VVD, that was Mark Rutte's party, who are now completely disgraced and almost, well, close to wiped out is an overstatement, but, you know, they've lost big time. Especially if you look at the map, on the map they indicate blue for Wilders or, you know, different colours for different parties, and the VVD are just nowhere to be seen, a couple of strongholds. So anyway, in this proportional representation, the VVD and Christian Democrats, they tended to be the two ruling parties, but they never actually had the 75 seats. Or they would maybe together make it to 74 seats, but obviously they needed 76 to have a majority in the lower house. So they would invite this Wilders guy or the Christian Union, which was even worse, fundamentalist Christians in the Dutch government, to make up the numbers. And then, of course, people think PR is a brilliant idea. But the party, the smallest party, holds the balance of power, because if they say we don't like what you're doing, we don't like that you're not actually carrying out our manifesto, you just do as you please, but hang on a minute, we've got a say in this, and if they walk out, the government crashes over one or two seats out of 150. So it's completely anti-democratic. It's not more democratic, it's completely anti-democratic that the smallest party blackmails an entire country. So that he has now got 37 seats. Another party, which is called NSC, who are also very right-wing, was born out of the whole child tax credit scandal. The new social contract, NSC, they also won a fair number of seats. This is a really new party, and it was born from the child tax credit scandal that caused the entire Rutte government to resign, I think, 2 years ago, and then miraculously they were back again. But he is basically a stickler for the constitution and for the rule of law, whereas Wilders is anything but. He has been trying for the last 20 years, he's been trying actively to create a two-tier citizenship basis for anyone who's not, white and blue-eyed, basically, who's not Aryan, shall we say, called a creature by its name. So all immigrants will be second-rate citizens, yeah, based on their origin and their creed. And then particularly Muslim, of course, not the expats. Heaven forbid anybody says anything about, or the Chinese. No, the Muslims. So this is completely unconstitutional. But he's apparently said, after the results of the elections became known, he said he is willing. Oh, my God, the gesture, you know, the grandiose gesture. He is willing to uphold the constitution. Like, what is that even? What mentality does it require to do that? I don't understand. The bottom line of the elections is that nobody on the left, but nobody on the left, is willing to create a coalition with this man because he's so odious. He's anti-Europe, which is, sorry, not anti-Europe, anti-EU, as am I. But many Dutch people are, obviously Holland was at the cradle of the Benelux. Benelux, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg. So the Dutch are overwhelmingly pro-EU. Then he's anti-immigration, which is very difficult because Holland actively invited Turkish and Moroccan immigrants back in the 70s to come and work in their tomato and flower greenhouses and bulb fields and what have you. And then were highly surprised when these people said, oh, life's good here, I think I'll stay. So back in 2004, I translated a PhD from Dutch into English, and it was about the rise of the extreme right wing all over Europe, including Britain, UKIP, and Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands, who was murdered. The rise of the extreme right wing, and especially the financing of the extreme right wing. And if you had to take who supplied the money for these people, I will tell you, it was Pfizer and it was Microsoft. Big sums of money to all the extreme right-wing parties. So for someone who's anti-globalization, to actually, it came via the Edmund Burke Foundation, which is a very questionable institution, one of these many shady NGOs. So anyway, no one on the left will want to govern with this man. So it looks like it'll be an extreme right wing coalition. So PVV won the 37 seats. So then that new social contract, who are basically saying, you know, the politics as we've had it for the last 20 years is completely dead. We need a new kind of politics with much more respect for the citizen and much more respect for the rule of law. They have 20 seats. The Christian Democrats, who were always the biggest party in Holland, always, they are now reduced to a mere 5 seats. And then the VVD, which is like the moderate conservatives, if you like, they have 24. And the farmers have 7 seats. So there you go.
Hi, everyone. I'm Millie. I go sometimes by the name of Jungle Bus Millie because I lived off grid in a Mercedes Vario bus that drove on vegetable oil. I've since become quite too ill and elderly to do a British winter, so I have to come indoors into what we call brick. So I'm spending my winter in brick. My activist past, I started out in life as an ordinary journalist, but one with very serious question marks over pretty much everything that I was told, from the Catholic Church to my teachers to the politics in my country, which is the Netherlands. And I tried to live a mainstream life. Obviously, when my children were small, I had a mortgage and needed to pay the bills. But as soon as they fled the nest, I turned to anti-fracking protests, and really, as an investigative journalist by then, tackling, trying to oppose in a campaigning sort of way the worst excesses of the world that we live in, this globalized world of ours, on this beautiful planet of ours. So that's it. Hi, everyone.
So we've decided to get together today, Millie, and I think in a way it's quite, you know, both you and I have worked in mainstream press and we've seen the way it's changed from this thing which is really serving the public to serving special interests more and more.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, during COVID, for example, literally turning news bulletins into advertising campaigns for Pfizer and Moderna.
Yeah.
And the spineless nature of modern journalism. I mean, you can't, in a way, blame journalists so much for this, because if they start to question the narrative, then the editors and the managers will show them the door. And so many of the journalists that are still remain, they're either sort of slavish morons like zombies, or else they are quite clever journalists who know how much they can get away with, but still try and serve the public within their job. So yeah. I don't know what you'd make of that analysis, but I mean, a lot of journalists get blamed, but the journalists don't own the transmitters, do they? They don't own the printing presses.
Exactly. Well, long before COVID, Tony, there was a German journalist who goes by the name of Ken Jebsen. He was a Russia and Ukraine specialist for one of the German mainstream television, I believe. Rundfunken is radio. Sorry, I said that wrong. Fernsehen. And he became so disgruntled with not being allowed to tell the truth as he found it, that he quit his mainstream job and he started a kind of movement in Berlin where he would just go to the city centre every single Friday, I believe Friday, Monday, it doesn't matter, with a microphone and just started talking to the crowds about, you know, big pharma, about oil and gas, about the banking system, about, you know, and during COVID, he was actually banned from his YouTube channel. Radio Ken was banned. So he's one. Anna Breeze, obviously, in the UK. She rose to fame for throwing in the towel, I think, with the BBC or ITV and trying to go it on her own. And she got severely punished. I was listening to a Belgian journalist called Karine. I forgot her surname. She sounded the alarm both with her media outlet, whatever that was, whether it was television or a paper, and the government. She actually wrote her report on what was happening with COVID to the Belgian Minister for Health, and she was completely sidelined. She actually found that the hospitals, which are largely privatized in Belgium, they received €1,600 for every COVID patient they admitted. So obviously then every patient who was admitted was a COVID patient because the government paid quite generously for that little label. And these patients were then never discharged from, well, they were discharged from the hospital, but not from the book, so that the hospitals continued to keep the money. So this journalist uncovered this, like, hang on a minute, there's all these ghost patients that are seemingly in hospitals that we have no capacity for. So there's some kind of massive fraud being committed here. And she was completely hushed. I think she lost her job even. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so there's a few others maybe. I mean, I'd like to mention Udo Ofkoti, who died in rather mysterious circumstances very shortly after. He was a German journalist. He's written a book in English. It's called Prestitutes in the Service of the CIA. He was quite openly talking about the disgust he had with his profession, where journalists were just simply handed articles which had been written by the American intelligence services.
Yes.
To inject into the newspapers, the German papers. The Prestitutes book is a fantastic read, really. It's amazing to see that the way that such a massive industry can be turned from an investigative public service into literally an advertising agency for these deep state. And then there's also Annie Machon and David Shaler, the MI5 officers that blew the whistle in the 1990s here. And I can remember talk they gave here in Bristol, they were saying something very, very fascinating, which was, look, we worked in MI5. We had a spy in every newsroom who was watching what was going on.
I was just going to say this, Tony, wasn't it called Operation Magpie? I think it was Magpie. It was a 1950s CIA program whereby...
You're talking about Mockingbird.
Mockingbird, that's right. I thought Magpie, yes, and I thought Magpie was more up to,
Well, I think Mockingbird, in a way, is also apt, isn't it? Because they're mocking the listeners, the viewers, and mocking the people who are digesting.
Yes, or a cuckoo, even, you know, putting a cuckoo in the nest. Yes, but that's been going on so since the 50s, wasn't it, where they placed journalists in newsrooms. And then, of course, you had the whole McCarthy era when nobody dared actually speak their minds. And then I remember when the war in Iraq was happening, this concept was suddenly born. That was the embedded journalist, and all the journalists had to sign contracts before they were even allowed into Iraq. Do you remember?
Yeah, and the ones that
only
didn't,
a handful,
and the ones that didn't, like
Fergus Keane.
Yeah, what the ones that didn't sign the contracts were actually bombed by the Americans and killed.
Yes,
we had famously one of the main ITV reporters. He was just bombed, and all his crew were killed.
So Fergus Keane, he actually said he was out standing on the bridge. He was just having a smoke outside the hotel, and this tank came rolling into Baghdad, and it was literally stopped, changed the angle of its gun towards the hotel, and then let rip. And he said the Americans afterwards kind of tried to make it seem as if it had been an accident, an accidental hit, just like the radio station in Belgrade. Remember that in 97 or something? They accidentally bombed the media, the main media center in Belgrade in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah. So I mean, there's been this kind of war on journalism.
Yeah.
I think it's useful also to contrast it with Radio Luxembourg in the Second World War, because that's where Lord Haw Haw was broadcasting in English to the British population. And the Ministry of Information in Britain, as it was at the time, very Orwellian sounding name. And of course, George Orwell was basically working there. They had a good discussion and chat about it all, and they said, well, actually it's best not to jam Lord Haw Haw because it's better to just ridicule him and literally to satirize him and let people listen, because they will if we jam this signal, which we could easily do, then that would just actually add fuel to the fire that we're trying to hide something. Now, in a way, what's going on now is the opposite. You know, we are blanking out and you know, hiding channels from Russia, from Iran, sorts of parts of the world, because if people were to see that, then they would realize the lies they're being told by our own press. And of course, you know, the press has been a major part of shaping opinion, although I think it's fair to say, Millie, see what you think about this, is that, you know, for many people now, they just don't trust it. In fact, the figures show that the trust in the British press is at an all-time low.
Well, I'm not surprised. Just see how The Guardian is pretty much owned by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, isn't it? And they're just a mouthpiece for whatever Bill Gates wants to tell the world. Similarly, the Independent practiced. I remember the Independent first coming out sometime in the late 80s or early 90s, and it was like, yay, finally an independent newspaper. And they're completely and utterly corrupt now. And anyway, the censorship, Tony, I was just I've been following an American investigative journalist called Matt Taibbi. He's been covering the Twitter files, which I find a massively interesting story. And it's just not been covered in the mainstream at all. You know, how the whole Russian meddling in the American elections, supposedly, that was all a story put out into the world by the Democrat Party. Nothing at all to do with Trump. And mind you, I'm not a Trumpist, but the censorship that resulted from that story. So anyway, Matt Taibbi has just uncovered that the British Labour Party, so he's now got what he calls the UK files. I haven't quite got to grips with the story yet, but apparently the Labour Party are also instrumental in the censorship of what is called the Center for Digital Hate and Misinformation, something like that. So it's not just the media. There's a very clear agenda on the part of the high politicians to actually silence the people.
So can you just explain the Twitter files in a nutshell then?
Well, when Elon Musk took over Twitter, he promised freedom of speech. That was his main concern for buying Twitter, was that it had become such a highly censored platform. So he basically, one of the first things he did was he sacked everybody who'd been concerned with just censoring tweets. And then he started releasing particular clusters of files. And from that, it appeared that the FBI had actually paid Twitter $3 million to silence particular stories. A lot of people who were on the Twitter board of directors were actually FBI agents, et cetera, et cetera. And so while Facebook had complied with instructions to make it seem that there had been Russian interference in the, was it 2016 elections? Twitter just said, we can't find it. We've looked absolutely everywhere, but we cannot find what it is you want us to show. In any event, so when Elon Musk took over, all these files relating to censorship on the COVID, any dissent in terms of the COVID narrative, any dissent in terms of the jabs, you know, the EU, the Ukraine story, any of that, any kind of the people actually saying, we don't believe what you're telling us, and this is my version of this story, was just censored. And it all came out when Musk took over Twitter.
Yeah, I don't know if it's really changed that much under Musk. For example, he's decided to release the Twitter accounts from jail of Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins just before the march in London, in order to try and get as many far right people out on the streets the next weekend as possible. I mean, there's obviously manipulation. Well, so what happens with the media? It's like if you go back to, go back to the 1980s, we had relatively free television where you could fairly easily get a documentary onto TV if you'd made it. And nowadays it's become less and less possible to do that. It's all completely like a closed shop. So the same sort of thing has happened with the big social media companies like Twitter and Facebook, where they opened up. Lots of people came in because they could share free information. Once they've got their market controlled, then they start to control things. I don't know what you think of it, but it seems to me at the moment the place where it's all happening is on TikTok, and maybe at some point soon TikTok's algorithms will change and a load of people will get banned from there too.
Well, I was very heartened to find that Rumble is taking a stance, of course. Rumble, the platform where everybody seeks refuge from censorship. So in the whole Russell Brand saga, which I have no opinion on whatsoever.
Really?
I have no opinion on it at all. Or not one that I choose to voice anyway.
Well, I'll tell you what I think is, I think that he's being got at because he's been speaking out against all sorts of things, like particularly about the Ukraine war and the Palestinian issue, these sorts of things. If somebody with a high profile does that, it seems that they just go for them.
Well, yes. I think, okay, then. I think Russell Brand rose to fame as an activist, really, during the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2008, if I remember correctly. And there was another person that I did many an anti-fracking camp with, who was accused of rape in that camp. And apparently he was also got at. The people who were actually in that camp said if anything had happened, there was so much gossip, the whole camp would have been rife with it, with stories. The same with Russell Brand. You know, it would have been all over the place at the time, and it wasn't. So, like you say, he was probably got at. Having said that, I'm not that fond of him as a. He's just copied the same old platform of celebrity presenter interviewing celebrity guest. And I am so bloody bored with that. You know, this, what you are doing, interviewing ordinary people. And I think that's where the future lies. There are lots of interesting people who've got really interesting stories and angles and what have you. And this whole celebrity culture is just, it's part and parcel of where it's gone wrong, isn't it?
No, I agree with. I mean, I agree with. I've never been a big fan of Russell Brand, but yeah. I can certainly.
No, but I'm trying to say, I think there's a lot of suspicion that he's actually part of the establishment.
I think he looks to me here as if he's being mugged because he's gone on a little bit off narrative or whatever. But anyway, look, we're wanting to talk about power particularly. And looking at the polls bit by bit, I just got a poll the other day saying 51%. Of the Dutch population want to see get rid of their royal family. Now, historically, here is probably in the UK has been a bit more dissent, but in Holland, they've been ever since the 1950s, if you go back that far, maybe, I don't know what it was before that, but there were figures like 80% of the Dutch supported the royal family. I think a lot of the reasons for this are, you know, if you're living in a country with good prosperity, you know, good job prospects, good quality of life, that sort of thing, then, you know, you think, well, yes, we haven't got a problem with our royal family. But the fact is that now, over the last 2 or 3 years, it's kind of turned the corner, where most of the Dutch population now, many of the polls say, want rid of them.
I think I read in one poll that their popularity had gone down to something like 29%, like an all-time low, like you say. There's a royalist magazine in the Netherlands, maybe there's something like that in the UK. Is there something called The Royals, a magazine that's for fans of the royal family? And they held a poll. So their readership are people who are, you know, royalists, who are in favour of the monarchy, fans even. And even amongst those, 75% of the readership of that magazine want to know exactly what it is that the royals do to justify the money that's spent on them. So let me just get this clear. They pay no tax. They pay no inheritance tax. They pay no gift tax. They own, I think it's, the official figure is $1 billion, but there's offshore accounts that came in the news maybe 10 years ago, maybe the Panama Papers even, there's massive offshore accounts. They will not declare what percentage of Royal Dutch Shell they own. Can you imagine that? And then on top of that, they get $1 million per year, just, I don't know, benefits. They don't pay any bills. They don't pay rent. They don't pay the upkeep of their houses. They don't pay any transport. They don't pay personnel, nothing. So that $1 million is just spendies. You know, and 75% of the readership of this pro-monarchy magazine want to know exactly what value for money they're getting. Then 69% say they should pay tax. 58%, so these are all majorities, say they have to be transparent now. Bizarrely, 55% say they must be protected better. Like, what does that mean? And then 53% say the cost of keeping them must go down. So that's quite telling. Of course, they went to their house in Greece a couple of times, twice, I think, during the lockdowns.
Yeah, that didn't go down very well, did it? I mean, you know, the idea that the whole population has to stay indoors, but they can just swan around on holiday. This is obviously going to, I mean, maybe they just hope that nobody, they wouldn't get into the press.
I don't know. I think all these people, all these high and mighty people are so entitled. But it's not just that they went on holidays. They took the Dutch government plane because Willem Alexander fancies himself as a pilot. So he just flies his family of five out to his house in Greece, you know, in times when all the Dutch farmers are getting chucked off their land because of their emissions. He flies a family of five in a Boeing 737, you know, on a private flight. It just beggars belief.
Listen, look, you just touched on the farmers issue. Can you just tell us what's going on in domestic politics? Because this, again, is likely to reflect badly, isn't it, on the royal family. If you've got, I mean, the farmers, I thought, you know, in New Zealand, they have the same slogan, no farmers, no food.
Yep, exactly. You see that also. So the connection with the royal family, every third Tuesday of September is what the Dutch call Prince's Day. And it's where the king reads the opening statement of Parliament for the year ahead. So basically the budget and, you know, items on the agenda of Parliament. Traditionally, the royal, the monarch, would arrive in a golden coach. No, a solid gold coach, actually, not golden gold. Which bizarrely, a number of years ago, somebody, you know, those little tin foil little cups that you get candles in. Do you know the sort? I mean, the tea candles. Do you know the little? Do you know what I mean? The little aluminium cups that hold the candles.
Yeah, tea lights, they're called.
Somebody threw one of those at the gold coach, and he was imprisoned for 2 years for threatening the monarch. He got 2 years prison sentence. Anyway, on that coach, there's an image that is the epitome of oppression and slavery. There's coloured people, you know, offering baskets of fruit and spices. And then there's this person accepting them. And then also there's a book being given to these native people, which apparently symbolises civilization. You know, civilization is handed to these primitive peoples, and in return they give food and sustenance. So there were so many objections to this that now the coach has been stored in a museum. It will no longer be used. However, this year on Prince's Day, they used a glass coach. And there were massive crowds with placards saying no farmers, no food. They were being hissed and booed at. It was quite a spectacle, you know, like, yeah, quite a lot of hate coming their way. So, yeah, so the farmers, apparently Willem Alexander. So this is a thing that really... that I find incomprehensible. So we have the separation of powers, supposedly. The monarch is not supposed to interfere in the democratic process or have any power really in that democratic process. But the Dutch really do exercise this. And before Willem Alexander became king, he said, if you're looking for someone to rubber stamp the laws and sign off and cut ribbons for the openings of hospitals, you've got the wrong guy, find somebody else. So he's clearly already cast himself as a king who wants to wield his power.
Well, you know what, this is very similar to Charles, isn't it? I mean, the Queen was her hands-off, Charles is very much hands-on. In fact, in our Remembrance Day service this November, a couple of weeks ago, you had Charles going in with Sunak and Cameron, former Prime Minister, after the service, walking into the Foreign Office directly from the cenotaph. Yeah. The next morning, they announced that Cameron is now going to be Foreign Secretary. So obviously, Charles is taking a much, much bigger role. Sunak, yes, in the background as the Goldman Sachs boy, you know, will do as he's told. You know, it's quite possible for these monarchs to actually wield a hell of a lot of power, as Bernhard did, for example, with, you know, his bribery scandal back in the 1970s.
Yes, absolutely. But I think Charles already exposed quite a long time ago for writing letters to government ministers saying I want you to do this and I want you to do that.
Yeah, that's
it?
Right. The black spider letters. That's right. Yeah. I mean, he's definitely taken a big role in all this. And one of the great things, of course, being a monarch, is that you get to look at all the laws. Certainly here in the UK, I don't know about Holland.
Yeah.
Anything that affects the royal family, they can just literally take a big black
veto
pen, strike it out. You know, before they sign it.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, the tomorrow, not yesterday. I told you yesterday there were national elections in the Netherlands. This isn't true. It's tomorrow, so I can't tell you the outcome. But on Friday, the King, Willem-Alexander, he is meeting with the Dutch Euro MPs, MEPs. And the items on the agenda are right at the top of the agenda is the viability of a net zero Europe. Now, why would the King meddle, or I call it meddling, wouldn't you? If the King had a meeting with elected members of parliament to discuss a particularly hot political item, I think that for me that's too far. That goes too far.
Well, it's very unpopular. It's extremely controversial. It would cost the public a vast amount of money.
Yes.
It's basically one of the most concerning policies that we've ever seen. This idea that, you know, you're not allowed to use fossil fuels at all, and everything will be scored on its. I mean, actually, one of the interesting things in the Panama Papers, Millie, was that King Charles, it turns out, has got a big stake in the carbon trading companies that were set up, and you know, he financially will personally benefit from any of this carbon trading.
Carbon offset, yeah. Well, that doesn't surprise me. So I'll just read out the items on the agenda for this meeting on Friday. So the viability of a net zero Europe, the expansion of the EU. Did you know that was on the card? The EU wants to expand. Then upcoming EU elections, digital transition. So this is last week, the EU Parliament in principle said yes to digital ID, which is then becomes linked to your bank account, to your biometrics, to your vaccine status, the whole kit and caboodle, that's on the cards. And then finally, the options for European-wide cooperation in terms of healthcare. Well, that looks okay if you just read those words on paper. What I see below that is as I said, the linking of vaccine status to digital identity. And let's not forget Willem-Alexander's wife, Queen Maxima. She was in charge of the United Nations program for microfinance, which is a very brilliant idea. But she's now the World Economic Forum's person in charge of digital money, digital finance. So there's all kinds of.
She's an interesting character, isn't she?
Well,
she comes from the family over in Argentina. One of the top ministers in the fascist government, the military dictatorship.
He was a minister. I think he was one of the generals of the junta. I think he was one of the members of the military junta that disappeared. Millions of people in Argentina, and actually it was a Dutch pilot who I think may have gone to prison for flying huge aeroplanes out over the Atlantic and literally open the hatches and just drop all these enemies of the state into the Atlantic.
Amazing. I mean, what about, maybe we could even just look at the links to the Nazis, because I know after the war, just reading up on all this, there were lots of war criminals obviously involved in collaborating with the Nazis in Holland. But it looks as if the people that got shot were the low-level ones. A lot of the very top war criminals, they actually got lenient sentences or were even pardoned by the post-war Dutch.
Yeah, I think, no, not so much by the Dutch. I think more at Nuremberg. I think we touched on this, that the industrialists and the financiers, Nuremberg just paid lip service to, you know, the notion of punishing them. But they really got off scot-free and then became instrumental in the setting up of first the Benelux and then the EEC and then what is now the EU. I think we touched on this in a previous broadcast, Tony, but that's absolutely the case. You know, Schiphol Airport was built with German money, like the Dutch grew rich off the occupation, like, I don't know, like the Americans, like it's such a cesspit, really, of conflicts of interest.
Yes, I mean, people don't know Argentina was ruled by a military dictatorship from 1976 till 1981, where Maxima's her father was a major player there. But I mean, going back to,
so he wasn't actually allowed at his daughter's wedding, so the Dutch part, the Dutch government approved the wedding of Willem Alexander and Maxima Zorreguieta. But her family were not allowed to come to the Netherlands to attend the wedding.
Wow, is that controversial? But of course, you know, these people seem to go on the kind of bloodlines for some reason. But look, getting back to him, Wilhelm, he's involved in this thing called the Minerva Club, isn't he? Where this is a bit like the Bullingdon Club in Oxford, which Cameron and Johnson were at.
Yeah, so Minerva is a quite old. The University of Leiden is, how old will it be? 400 or 500 years, I think. So Leiden in the Netherlands is where Willem Alexander went to university too. He earned himself the nickname of Prince Pilsner because of his, you know, his escapades and his drinking and partying. Also, interestingly, the university, there's a particular building called the Academy building, which is, it's very old and very beautiful. And they, in that building, there's always posted the exam results. So whichever faculty has a bout of exams, all the results are just on the wall of the Academy building. Maybe now it's digitalized, but certainly in the 70s when I studied there, and in the 80s when he studied there, that was the custom. So all the exam results were published. However, he was such an appalling student, and I don't think he's very bright at all. He's maybe shrewd, but he's certainly not cognitively high-flying, shall we say. They actually stopped publishing the exam results because they were so embarrassing for the royal family. So that was a little anecdote for you. Anyway, he sponsors this this fraternity of Minerva, and it costs quite a bit of money to become a member. Quite often, if you join, when you join, first of all, there's horrific hazing ceremonies that people have died in, and they keep trying to outlaw them, forbid them, but obviously, you know, if all the high and mighty people in the country come from that club, then, you know, it's pretty much untouchable.
Yeah. So what kind of things go on? Hazing is kind of initiation, isn't it?
Yeah. But it tends to go on for a week. So first of all, as I said, it's very expensive to join. Other clubs make you work for like 2 or 3 weeks, like working in onion fields or whatever, and then you have to give your wages to the club. Minerva just charges this massive entrance fee. And then the hazing can be, the people who've died, one guy was made to drink something like 20 litres of beer in an hour, you know, drink this beer or you're out, and he drank and his kidneys exploded. Another guy was made to dress up in a Santa costume that they then set fire to and told him to jump in the canal. And by the time he reached the canal, he had third degree burns. So he died. When my daughter went through, she didn't go with Minerva, but the club that she tried to join, it was reminiscent of the Stamford Prison Experiment. They switched off all the lights. There were like 80 people in a pitch dark room with no air on it during a heat wave in August. And then there were these seniors with baseball bats or cricket bats, and they were literally slamming through the room like this, making it seem like any second you could get hit. It was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And she phoned me up like midday and she went, ah, no way am I joining this lot of psychos. So that's the sort of thing that goes on. But in any event, long story short, so Willem Alexander sponsors Minerva. And unless you have been through Minerva, you don't get to enter diplomatic service. You don't get to come to things like, you know, state funerals, all the kind of events where young, ambitious lawyers get introduced to the older generations or, you know, people of influence. You just don't get to attend that unless you are at Minerva.
Yeah, it's a clique, isn't it?
Boys club, yeah.
And the idea is, you know, either in or out of the clique. That's not obviously democracy at all. I think the purpose of these rituals is to sort of you have to sort of submit. The idea is that, you know, you may be clubbed around the head with a baseball bat and you're actually you're actually going along with that. And it's similar with, I think, with the many of these, you know, secret society initiations where you have to agree literally to have your throat cut and things like that in order to join. So, you know, there's obviously there's a sort of threat of, it's like, well, if we want, we can kill you. If you agree to that, then you can be part of us.
Yeah. Well, this brings me back to, you know, the Belgian journalist that I mentioned earlier who tried to expose this scandal with Belgian private hospitals creaming lots of tax money off the government. She used the word omerta. There was an omerta on journalists to stay with the mainstream narrative or else. So, and speaking of omerta, interestingly, go completely off on a tangent, apparently there's been a mass whistleblowing going on in the Italian mafia. Everybody's spilling the beans all of a sudden. So there'll be quite a few revelations coming out. You know, I would anticipate involvement of the Vatican, obviously. That's anyway, shall we talk about the farmers, Dutch farmers then?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Because we touched on that, so that's quite a pressing issue. There's a Dutch journalist called, oh, what is she called? Elze van Hamelen. It's all in Dutch, so sadly, unless people understand Dutch, it'll be pretty hard to follow. But she basically sketches the attack on farmers and fishermen that's been going on again since actually before the Second World War, but back in those days people wouldn't hear of it. But then the Second World War itself was such a massive shock to the system. I don't know if you're familiar with Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. You know, you have this massive shock happening to the world, and then in the vacuum of that, all kinds of legislation gets brought in that people would otherwise not accept. So, for example, the tsunami in Southeast Asia was a shock doctrine. The killing of President Allende was a shock doctrine that allowed the politics of Milton Friedman to then take hold on the world, etc. So anyway, she mentions that the Second World War was such a shock. And then this legislation or this program came in after the Second World War, which would translate into English as the redistribution of land. And so basically, like in the UK, farmers would hold tiny little fields, you know, like sometimes miles apart, like a field in one village and two fields in another village. And they were all separated by hedgerows and what have you. And the Dutch government decided that monoculture and large-scale farming was the order of the day, and so all these farmers had to have big chunks of land, so they would measure up how much each farmer had and then say, you no longer own those fields in that next village, but in return you get to have this one chunk of land. So to do that, do you understand, so they ended up with the same acreage, but all in one chunk rather than in lots of different chunks. So if you now fly into Schiphol, you see all these perfect squares in the bulb fields, which is the result of that policy. So as a result of that, all the hedgerows had to come up. For example, like Holland literally lost hundreds of thousands of miles of hedgerows. Then she describes in the 60s, it became clear to the Club of Rome and all those kind of people who were trying to do long-term planning, it became clear that there was large urbanization going on. And as a result of the urbanization, so young people all going to the cities, the need was identified to bring food production under state control, because after all, if everybody lives in cities, then who's going to grow the food? So that's really when the attack properly started, to get the farmers, the private ownership of land, to make that a thing of the past, seize control of the land and seize control of the food production, and then the state owns it all. So this is a complete topsy-turvy world where the state literally carries out its remit of representing the people and has instead become the tyrant, telling the people how to live, what to eat, where to live, etc. So first the farmers were hit with all the excessive use of phosphates that they had to reduce, and got penalized and got fined on. Then they got penalized with what's called a tax forfeit. So every farmer, purely by virtue of having land, has to pay a set amount of tax. I believe it's maybe €1,000 per year, just because they have the ability to grow food, regardless their own food for private consumption, regardless of whether they do. The fact that they own this land means they have to pay this forfeit, because they deprive the state of VAT on shop bought items. That is the idea behind this forfeit. And now, of course, they're being hit with this whole nitrogen nonsense, really. So this new political party was formed called the Farmers and Civilians, so the BBB in Dutch, and they won big time in the upper house elections. But it's become clear that they've actually embraced the notion that indeed they do emit too much nitrogen, although there is so much evidence to say that that's a nonsense. But the farmers seem to be going along with that. So the only issue is that they do not want to reduce their nitrogen emissions to the government's schedule, but to their own. So lots of people feel quite betrayed by them.
And one other thing I'll just chip in, because we've got Jim Rogerson. he works in the farming industry, and he's also a Conservative councillor up in the Ribble Valley in Lancashire. He's been saying his theory, which I quite like, which is that there's such an attack on livestock, because the livestock on farms that are owned by the farmers, there's no way that the food industry can touch them, because the grass is the farmer's grass, and the livestock are eating that, and that is a food product which the big corporations don't control, because it's the farmer's land. Even if it's a tenant farmer, they've got a lot of sway over that product. So the idea is that these big multinationals like Cargill, you might say with chickens, but actually the feed for the chickens is controlled by the big corporations. And yep. So the only bit of the food chain which is not under control is that of the livestock farmers.
Well, can I field a little conspiracy theory here? Just a hunch. All of a sudden, Tony, there is an outbreak on the continent. Germany, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, and already one case in the UK of an emergent strain. Now, where have we heard that before, if not the pandemic, the coronavirus, emergent strain of the blue tongue virus? And apparently this makes cattle quite sick. I'm reminded of the foot and mouth thing in, was it 1998 or something, 99? Do you remember that, where we all had to, we had to walk through this disinfectant straw, and you had to take your shoes off before you could walk in a field because you might spread foot and mouth. And apparently it's a completely harmless condition, didn't affect the livestock very much at all, but lots and lots of animals were culled. Same with what was her name, Edwina somebody, what was that minister called with the salmonella chicken? She shagged John Major, sorry to use that word.
Oh yeah, Curry.
Yeah, so all the chickens were culled, weren't they? And so now I imagine lots and lots of cattle are going to get culled because of this blue tongue emergent strain. And interestingly, on a government website, I saw 770 French head of cattle have been clinically diagnosed to have this virus. But double that number have been diagnosed by PCR. We all know blooming well that PCR tests don't work. So, you know, call me a conspiracy theorist, but again, here we go again, don't we?
Well, yeah, quite possibly. Anyway, look, just getting back to the Dutch royal family, there's also, I mean, these basic things that people may not know, and the same applies in Britain, the actual monarch is above the law formally, because they can't be prosecuted for anything, even murder or that sort of thing. And we've seen recently in Britain large parts of the civil service given that same immunity from prosecution, including the security services, so they can break the law with impunity. So there's increasing numbers of people really spreading down from the monarch in Britain are just above the law, like Judge Dredd or something. You know, that the law doesn't apply to them, which is a way of sort of formalizing this separation of wealth between the rich and the poor. So with your Dutch king, he is another one of those, isn't he? That
not only is he above the law, there's a law that is called lèse majesté. How does that, I don't know what that is in English even. It's when you insult the monarch, that's actually a criminal offence. So as I said, this person who chucked a little aluminium tea candle holder at the gold coach like it was going to make a dent, insulted the monarch and went to prison.
Well, this is like China. Hang on, this is like President Xi. You know, if you criticise President Xi or wear a President Xi T-shirt, you can be arrested and banged up in China.
Yeah, well, talk about T-shirts. It's almost the time of the Dutch St. Nicholas celebration. St. Nicholas being the equivalent of Santa Claus, Father Christmas in the UK. So St. Nicholas brings the presents from Spain, and he is accompanied by people who represent Moors from the time of the Moors occupation of Spain, but nowadays they are blacked up Dutch people who wear gollywog costumes, as I say, black their faces. And I think about maybe 10 years ago, a black person from Suriname, which was a Dutch colony, wore a T-shirt while, so St. Nicholas comes into Holland 3 weeks before the actual 5th of December, and the 3 weeks are used to gather information on whether children have been good or not. And, you know, like here, you would have Santa Claus, Father Christmas in shops and that sort of thing. So there was the formal welcoming of St. Nicholas into the Netherlands. He arrives by boat, and there was this Suriname guy wore a T-shirt that said St. Nicholas is racist. And again, he was arrested. He was arrested for wearing a T-shirt and served a prison sentence. Then he wrote to the United Nations, and they sent a special rapporteur to come and investigate this horrendous tradition. I mean, it beggars belief in the 21st century that it's okay to black up, you know. And the special rapporteur decided, no, this has got to be a thing of the past. You can't do this anymore. And it ripped the Netherlands' opinion in half. There's a very famous singer called Anouk. She came out on the side. She spent quite a lot of time in America and in Britain, I believe. And she came out on the side of the banning of this tradition. I mean, if you have to put a color on your face, be yellow or green, but anything but black because of the connotations. And she got death threats, literally. She had to have a security detail to protect her. Speaking of which, a Dutch politician has just been assaulted for the second time. He's ended up in hospital, assaulted by a member of the public who didn't agree with his policies. And again, that's got a history in Holland, hasn't it? Pim Fortuyn got murdered. Theo van Gogh, the filmmaker, he got murdered. Constant attacks on people who say things you don't like.
So we've also, I mean, I'd like to look briefly, if you don't mind, at the history here, because one of the things I think has been changing is the way that these countries in Europe particularly have been run. From monarchies quite often over towards more of a republican point of view. Obviously, a monarch is a very, interesting way of doing things. It's not at all democratic. But then the thing is, if you get a decent monarch, it can actually be a blessing, so it all depends on the personality of the person and how, whether they've got a bit of a conscience or whatever. But look, let's go back to the English Civil War in the 17th century, in the 1600s, because we had a kind of tug of war going on, really, with the feudal classes represented by Charles I against the merchant classes represented by, the capitalists, the upcoming capitalist people represented by Oliver Cromwell and the City of London, who were very much involved in all of the. So Charles I gets his head chopped off. The dictatorship that follows, which was a military dictatorship by Oliver Cromwell, is such an utter disaster that when he dies, the country as a whole decides, look, this was a real bad mistake. Let's bring back Charles II, who's Charles I's son. He'd been in exile in France. So he comes back as the monarch for a few decades. But then you get this thing called the Glorious Revolution at the end of the 1600s, where the Dutch royal family, the House of Orange Nassau, the same people who are there today, bring King Billy over, who then goes to Ireland and causes all sorts of massacres over there. So it's almost as if the Dutch then collaborated with the City of London and the capitalist class to boot out the feudal king. I mean, this has led to something called Jacobism, which is a mainly Scottish movement, which was saying, well, hang on, our Stuart family were good kings. They were pretty good, actually. And you've just booted them out with King Billy coming over. So the Jacobites were around for a good couple of hundred years and even had a big rebellion. Mm-hmm. So there's been this kind of relationship between British and the Dutch where, yeah, when things looks like they're going the wrong way for the capitalists in Britain, they bring the Dutch in to sort things out.
Also, when you had to build your tidal barrier in the Thames and British engineers couldn't do it, you had to bring the Dutch in to finish it. And what was the other one? The London Eye, that had to be up for the millennium. And there was all kinds of problems and they had to seek Dutch engineers to actually come and do it because, all the windmill technology. Anyway, that's by the by. I'm not proud of my country at all. Yes. So in Dutch history, we used to be a colony. So the whole history of the European continent, of mainland Europe, I should say, is quite convoluted. So there was the big houses. There was the Francian Empire with Charlemagne, and there was the Burgundians, and then there was also the Merovingians before the Franks. Merovingians, Franks, Burgundians. And then eventually, the Dutch ended up being a colony of Spain, the Spanish Empire. So this is the time that Henry VIII was married to Catherine of Aragon. We were a Spanish colony. What we are taught at school is that the Dutch wanted to be Protestant. And independent, really. Obviously, it's a story of taxation and land ownership, and the Dutch were the best shipbuilders in the world, and they wanted to own their own colonies. You know, they were going out into the world and finding land, and there's these Spanish people going, thank you very much, ka-ching. So in any event, there was an 80-year war that ended in 1648 with the Treaty of Westphalia, and all of a sudden, I think then the Netherlands becomes the 7 United Republics or something, and all of a sudden there's this figure, William of Orange, who is a stadthouder, and there's not actually any kind of definition of what this title exactly entailed. What was this man, a king? Was he in any event, they increasingly consolidated their power until they became so powerful that by 1789 was the French start of the French Revolution. And the Dutch actually booted them out. The Dutch said, no more monarchy. We are a republic, you know, along with the French sentiment of brotherhood. What is it? Brotherhood, freedom, and liberté, fraternité, and equality. Equality, liberty, and brotherhood. So they booted the monarch out, who then again I think fled to Ireland, but I don't know if that was the same, was that the same era and the same Billy? Anyway, he was booted out. Holland was quite happily a republic, and then comes Waterloo, and William of Orange fights on the side of the Brits, and the Dutch people fight on the side of Napoleon because they don't want this royal man back. But obviously Napoleon lost, and they've been back ever since. Now, this story has got another angle, namely that the Rothschilds are said, the Rothschild Bank, the most powerful family in the world, apparently, they are said to have acquired their wealth by misinformation to the City of London, basically saying, oh, Napoleon has won, all is lost.
Well, no, listen, I'm going to chip in again, yeah, because there was actually a court case where the Rothschilds tried to sue somebody who suggested that they had used this devious tactic to lie to the London Stock Exchange to get them to sell everything really cheap to them, mm-hmm, because they conned them into thinking that we'd lost the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah, exactly.
And they lost the court case. So this is a fact. We can say 100% that this did happen.
OK, so ever since, and again, you know, it sounds like you and I were just jumping from one topic to another, but it's all of it connected. So the City of London, so the power, when you say they bring in the Dutch, the powerhouses, the core, the centres of power on this planet are Washington, D.C., which is not part of an electoral system, the City of London, which is Crown Corporation, not part of the United Kingdom, the Vatican, and then these no man's land kind of areas where the royal houses of Europe are completely unaccountable and above the law and, you know, potential assassins, as you say. And the Dutch are very powerful. If you look at the American, the names of the oldest families in America, for example, Stuyvesant, Roosevelt, Vanderbilt, the Rothschilds were Dutch Jews. You know, like all of these houses have come from the time that it was New Amsterdam. Yeah, and the whole idea of this manifest destiny that is behind, apparently, this idea of one world government, the manifest destiny of this, the selected few, that is a Calvinist idea. God favours you. You are rich because God favours you. So you don't.
Well, that's, isn't it interesting? I mean, that came along to sort of boot the Catholics out. And this was a mercantile religion, which was taking the Bible and kind of framing it in this capitalist terms. Well, it's okay to make lots of money and it's good. And
yeah, exactly.
What they don't really say is that, you know, you mustn't be sort of starving and killing people in the process. They don't really seem to talk about that much.
Oh, well, they do.
Oh, do they?
Oh, yeah, they do. So I mentioned the gold coach of the Dutch royals earlier. Which had to be abandoned because of the slavery. Well,
So did they melt it down and give it to, did they melt it down and give the money to the poor?
Yeah, right. I think I will sooner see Jeffrey Epstein's contact book than I will see the Dutch royals giving money to the poor. No, they apologised for their for the role in slavery, like Tony Blair did a number of years ago. They actually apologised and went, look, you know, you can't condemn historically what wasn't law at the time. You know, that was the, but we're very sorry, blah blah blah, it ever happened. However, the dominant religion of South Africa, for example, is called DP, which is Dutch Protestant. And the Bible that goes with that religion actually states that the races shall be separate. So it was OK to introduce apartheid because blacks were separate from whites. You know, so yeah, they weren't people at all. You could transgress against them because they were not people.
This is pretty dubious stuff. I think the other thing, just looking at power generally, is, I mean, things like the World Economic Forum, they are a kind of a bit like, in a way, the Bilderberg, which is the idea is the policy has already been decided. The idea of the World Economic Forum is just to get it out there, really. And the Bilderberg, what they do is they just filter through potential politicians to make sure they're all on board before they get any backing from the press and the banking system and the cartels. So, you know, there's this process going on, but behind all that you've got to have you know, a kind of cadre of believers in this globalist plan and in this kind of plan of slavery in terms of wage slavery. In other words, you know, the rich are entitled to do what they want, whereas the poor are a separate class, you know, and well, they can just go hang, we don't really care about them. You've got to have a cadre in each country of these people who are kind of pushing this behind the scenes a bit. And it seems to me you've got one of the main ways of doing that is through things like these orders of knighthood, like the Knights of Malta. In Britain, very, very interesting, I think, is the Order of the Garter, where we've just had the Queen Consort Camilla and Tony Blair brought into the Order of the Garter, which is one of the oldest, I think it's the oldest in Europe, actually, of these orders of knighthood, which was always there to sort of the so-called protect the royal family. But really, the idea is to make sure that nobody with any humanity ever makes it into the royal family, and that, you know, that seems to be the object. So what do you make of the way that power really works? Because there's big transitions going on and they have to be managed. You can't just allow, you know, the press or any other powerful interest groups to derail the big push for globalism.
What do I make of it? I don't know. I swing between unbridled optimism and complete pessimism and depression. There is such huge loss of freedoms in just such a very short space. There seems an awful lot of pushback from common people. I don't think it's enough. I think you know, this idea, the digital ID. There was a Dutch Euro commissioner called Nelly Smit. She fielded the idea of internet ID. So every single website that you visited would be known to the authorities that you'd looked at that website through your digital, your online presence, if you like, your online ID. That was overwhelmingly dismissed. Tony Blair was pushing from 1997 onwards. He was really pushing for this. Everybody had to be in the DNA database. Everybody had to have this biometric identity. When the Conservatives came back in 2010, wasn't it, that Cameron came back when he defeated Brown? That was the first thing, the first law they scrapped, apparently, or the first idea that they scrapped was this whole idea of everybody having to constantly show papers. Ausweisbitte in German. So this is a really, really scary idea. it's very hard for me as a Dutch person to say the difference between an idea and an ID. But it's really close in terms of vowels. So I hope I'm actually getting it. I don't know. I honestly don't know, Tony. I don't know what to. As I keep saying,
do you have anything similar to something like the Garter, the Order of the Garter?
Yeah,
it's a German royal family we've got in Britain. I mean, you know, you can't almost expect them to. Well, they had to change the name in World War One in order to deflect from the fact that the Gotha bombers that were bombing London were actually some company that was started by the British royal family. You know, that's a bit embarrassing. So there definitely seems to be almost like a kind of a hidden Holy Roman Empire still going on today.
Oh, but absolutely. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah, we also have these orders, the Order of the Garter, and there's obviously the Order of the of Orange Nassau. There's all kinds of, I've never quite delved into it, but yeah, all kinds of secret societies and dealings and
I mean, it's a bit of a dead giveaway when you get, you know, war criminals like Blair being recruited into this, you know, that and I think also, I don't know what you make of the, because, you know, the King Charles very much in charge, putting Cameron, the destroyer of Libya, suddenly straight back into the Foreign Office as if butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, you know, this guy who can't really be trusted by any foreign power.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing, really. Obviously, no foreigner is going to deal with Cameron. They know what he's like. They know he's a liar. They know he's a regime change agent. And so it's like sending, you know, destruction of British foreign policy deliberately. And it seems very clear and obvious to me that this is Charles's choice, and he's now sitting in the driving seat. But,
yeah, but
at the end of the day, of course, you can't. He's not going to. There's no way he's going to carry the people along in this.
Yeah. But look in Holland. So there's Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who's been in the saddle since also, I think, since 2010 or something. His cabinets keep collapsing and imploding and blowing up and what have you. And he just keeps coming back. It's unbelievable. Anyway, he's now finally he resigned. And as of tomorrow's elections, he will be leaving politics. Nonetheless, having said that, he is now travelling all over the world, like Tony Blair. I think he is aiming for a Middle East peace envoy kind of role, because clearly that's a ticket to unbridled wealth. If you look at what Tony Blair is worth these days. He's also been seen having lunch with, is he called Stoltenberg, the head of the Secretary General of NATO? And apparently that position is up for election next year. So this Mark Rutte, he was discredited over a very deliberate tax policy for putting the thumbscrews on Dutch taxpayers and accusing them willy-nilly, it seems, of tax fraud by getting tax credits for childcare. So, you know, if two people work, they get some kind of tax credit to help them pay for the childcare and to make that second job, having that second job worthwhile. There's no point, obviously, a woman going to work if her entire wages go on childcare. So anyway, lots and lots of people were accused of having defrauded the Dutch state, and they literally got bills from the tax office basically saying, you owe us €60,000, you must pay this tomorrow, otherwise the day after tomorrow we're going to confiscate your house. And this was actually executed with such haste. Lots and lots of people lost their houses, people died, you know, heart attacks, suicides, children were taken into care. Absolute nightmare, that the Middlesbrough scandal that we had in the 80s with Henrietta Hicks accusing all these people of child abuse, that's comparable, that springs to mind. In any event, the entire Dutch government had to resign over this scandal in 2021. Lo and behold, a few months later, there's been elections. They're back in the saddle again, but now he's properly gone. So again, this is a man who's a liar. He is callous. He has no clue about ordinary people. He is a WEFer. He reminds me of Grima Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, that you know, that sneaky agent of Saruman, who's the wizard turned bad, the corrupt wizard. He sends his Grimer worm tongue to whisper policies into the ear of the king to kind of, that's what he reminds me of, this Rutter. He's such a slimy character, like Blair. You can just see the
In a way, what you're describing here is fascinating because the mask seems to be slipping. I mean, we started off talking about the ratings of the popularity of the Dutch royal family, you know, falling through the floor. In a way, I mean, let's maybe finish by getting your take on what's been happening in Gaza, because the Israelis, which everyone is supposed to be so sorry for over the Holocaust and anti-Semitism all the time, it's now becoming clear that these fake claims of anti-Semitism were absolutely preparing for this slaughter that's been going on in Gaza. So maybe you can, I mean, it just seemed to me that the elites are on the back foot. They've actually almost given up on trying to convince people anymore. And they're pursuing their kind of psychopathic aims towards having some sort of, you know, pseudo-religious war over there, you know, with the Zionists versus the whole Muslim world. They're going to try and maybe have even a third world war, trying to drag in the Americans and the Russians into a, you know, to try and keep the survival of Israel or whatever. But anyway, what do you make of Gaza finally?
apparently Rishi Sunak's company, what are they called, Infosys, is that his company, they have already signed a contract with Israel to exploit Gaza's oil, as if that's Israel's to give away. Have you seen that? Have you had that on your horizon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, I mean, it seems to me like a kind of religious war-driven land grab. So the idea is that you're grabbing
all wars are over land.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing, when I say religious war, I mean, the idea is a land grab under cover of a religious war. So it's not really anything to do with religion, just like Northern Ireland. You know, it's actually about who controls the land and how you can bamboozle the population into thinking it's okay for you to kick a load of people off, you know.
Well,
and
Rothschilds own Israel. They bought the land in Israel. They bought the land in around about 1900. That's quite clear. It's Rothschild's land that Israel is founded on.
It's the future for the Dutch monarchy. How long can they last as their ratings are falling through the floor?
Well, I think it's already on the cards that Willem Alexander is going to abdicate. I think he's going to go fairly soon. I don't think he likes the job very much. And his eldest daughter, what's her name? Amalia. She's now 18. She actually attends state functions like the Prince's Day, Budget Day. So there is a notion that she will take over quite soon, but she is possibly even more hated than he ever was. So I don't know. I'd love to see them go. I'd love to see a world redistribution of resources towards something much more equitable. You know, I don't begrudge rich people their wealth, but equally I don't wish poor people their poverty.
Rather than to just sort of try and sell some kind of dream, everything's going to be fine. No. But I mean, I would like to just chip in, you know, with my view on all this, is that these elites really are on a hiding to nothing, that they have cut themselves off from humanity, and their ideals are not going to work. The people won't accept them. They don't want them. More and more we're seeing this, and that perhaps people like King Charles and King Wilhelm, their days are numbered.
Well, the downside of that view, Tony, is that they control, as you said earlier, they control our food. They control the air that we breathe. I am and will, to my dying day, be convinced that COVID was sprayed on us, and they've done that before. I was looking at DDT, the history of DDT yesterday, bizarrely. they actually thought DDT could cure polio, and they literally came into a classroom and sprayed it full of DDT while these kids are sitting eating their lunch. I mean, it's that kind of mania. They sprayed the populations of Devon and Norfolk in the 1950s and 60s because they thought the Russians might do it at some point, so they might as well see how resilient the British public were. And this is declassified documents. I've seen archive footage of these little army lorries driving through these villages, literally spraying women with newborn babies in prams, you know. And now we have this cancer epidemic. And I think if these elites want to depopulate the world, they're doing a fine job, you know, in just inflicting all their chemical shit on us. And now this insect food that's been approved by the European Union, this aceta, you know, any food stuff that you buy that has aceta in the ingredient list, that's basically insect flour. And there's no clinical trials for that to say it's safe, or, you know, would people choose to buy it if they knew? So I don't know. I'm feeling pretty down. But I decided last year sometime to adopt the serenity prayer of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is basically, you know, help me accept the things that I can't change, and let me know, and let me change the things that I can. So that's basically been my tack.
Okay, Millie, I don't know how much you're on social media, but are there any sites that you can recommend that you think, you know, actually got a bit more decent information on them?
In terms of news? I look occasionally at an American couple in Portugal. They're called Redacted. They call themselves Redacted. They have quite a refreshing angle on news. There's a lot of good journalism coming out of America. There's a channel called The Hill. There's, of course, Tucker Carlson, who went completely rogue, thank God, you know, who's vindicated and now a bit of a star in a kind of Robin Hood journalism kind of way. So follow these people, listen to what they say. There's, you know, you may not like their politics, but certainly what they say, they will speak the truth.
Okay, Jungle Bus Millie, thanks very much for joining us again from Exeter.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Tony.